You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Arlen Hamilton, and this is the Earn and Invest Podcast.
The date was December 4th, 1993, and my friend Iran had bought us tickets to the Janet Jackson concert in Detroit. We left the Ann Arbor campus, I was a junior at the time, and borrowed a friend's car. It was the Janet tour celebrating her Rhythm Nation album. Of the many memorable moments that night, the biggest was during the 10th song of the set, when she sat down on a chair alone on stage and quietly sang her hit song, Again. And then the music stopped right there in the middle of the song, and she started to cry. Overtaken by the emotion of the song, she wept alone on stage for about a minute, and then she began to sing again. 8 short months later, my guest today, a 13-year-old at the time, went to her first Janet Jackson concert in Texas. And just like me, it had quite an effect on her. In fact, it changed the trajectory of her life, but for a completely different reason. Arlen Hamilton is a 43-year-old author, investor, serial entrepreneur, and podcast host who went from being homeless just a few years ago to now running Backstage Capital. Currently, she raises and invests millions of dollars with underrepresented founders, including women, people of color, and members of the LGBTQ+ community to help them get their businesses up and running. Her new book is Your First Million, Why You Don't Have to Be Born into a Legacy of Wealth to Leave One Behind. Arlen Hamilton, welcome to Earn and Invest. In a moment, we're going to talk about how that night at that concert in Texas changed your life. But first and foremost, did she cry up on stage when you went?
Well, thanks for having me, Jordan. Yes, she did cry. Well, she stopped. She paused. And she was very emotional. She didn't shed tears. But I've seen her a few times during that moment. I've seen video of her. And I think she's just so taken aback by the crowd. But she doesn't cry every night, but she takes a pause to take it all in.
I used to think that was fake, honestly, but now as the years have passed, I realize that it was just an incredibly emotional period for her in the show. As I mentioned, this was kind of a game changer for you going at the age of 13. What happened during that concert that changed things for you?
Well, it was my very first concert I'd ever been to. My mother originally could not afford the tickets for us to go see her. And she was, Janet just was my hero, still is in a lot of ways. But then she surprised me with a ticket. She had one ticket she was able to get. It was in the back. And so this was before, you know, iPhones and all sorts of things. And so I went into the venue alone. She sat outside in her car. And she was very worried, but she sent me in as a 13-year-old. She gave me some hoop earrings and I think some lipstick because she wanted me to look a little older so nobody would kind of talk to me. And I ended up sitting next to these two teenagers who were a little bit older than I was. I was 13. They were probably 15 or 16. And they were just very exotic to me, very cool to me. And we just started talking about how much we love Janet. And we're kind of, you know, moving our hands around and laughing and so happy. And I guess we caught this person's attention. So this man walked over to us and he said, you look like big fans. And I was like, wait a second. I know this game. My mom taught me about people like you. Hold up. What are you trying to pull? And he smiles and he says, actually, I get it, but just keep your, how would you like to see Janet in the front row? And I was like, oh yeah, this guy. And he said, no. You keep your tickets. If I'm lying to you, just come back and sit back down. No harm, no foul. So I thought about it and I said, okay, on behalf of all three of us, we're allowed to go. We're going to check this out because I was this young kid who controlled everything. And so we started walking and walking and no one stopped us. We kept walking and walking and no one stopped us. And we get to the front row and not only did they not stop us, but they welcomed us, the ushers. And it was true. He had real tickets to the front row. It turned out that he was Renee Elizondo, who was her current husband at the time. Everyone knew that they were a boyfriend and girlfriend, but they had secretly gotten married. I didn't know him from Adam at that point. And she, Janet, likes to have a certain energy in the front row. I would go on to learn. And so she has her people bring people to the front row to spice things up a little bit. And it was a transformative time in my life for many reasons. One of them was it was the first time I saw gay men happy. I had always been taught in the religion I was in, growing up, I had been taught that gay men specifically were very wrong and bad. We didn't really talk about gay women because it wasn't as prevalent. I saw happiness, I saw families, I saw all kinds of people, I saw gay women. That was a big turning point for me because I thought, oh, this is beautiful, actually. This is not scary. This is not bad. This is beautiful. I would go on to understand that I myself am gay. And I think that had a lot to do with like being able to accept myself sooner than I probably would have. It also made me really love being around concerts. I ended up for a part of my adult life being a tour production coordinator and tour manager in different aspects. We can talk about that if you like. And then most of all, what it taught me was, or what it did for me was taught me that I could be anything. Because this amphitheater in Dallas, Texas was on fire in the best way. And it was all because of this black woman on stage. And everyone was singing every lyric, as you know from your time in Detroit, because Detroit was, I've been to a Detroit Janet show. Detroit goes off.
Yeah, and that was of that tour, that was in 93. So that was at the beginning of the tour. So like all the energy was there.
So I didn't see it for that tour, but I saw it for the next tour. I was in Detroit because I had to be at her, more than one show. But I just thought, wow, it just gave me the sense of like the world is so big and I didn't realize. And there's so much out there. And it opened my mind and it gave me this daring spirit that I've had ever since.
This story is at the beginning of your book. And at least my interpretation as I'm reading this, I'm like, that was the first time she had a seat at the table, right? Because that was a place of privilege. Like sitting in the front row at a Janet Jackson concert is a place of privilege. You didn't particularly come from a place of privilege, did you? Talk about your upbringing. What was it like growing up in your neighborhood, in your family?
I would say my neighborhood wasn't too distinct. I mean, we were in a middle class neighborhood in Dallas, Texas. I went to a very great school, well known for its football team and everything else, sports related. But it was more about the fact that my mother had a really hard time keeping head above water for us. And I worked since I was 14 or 15. I had a retail job since then, and every penny that I earned, I poured into the house. And so I learned very early, kind of the work ethic sort of thing. And it was I think for my mom, it was a combination of her not, like, I think there were systemic things at play for sure. She grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, a very poor state, a very unhealthy state, or city, I should say, for both. And she didn't have many role models when it came to finance, for sure. But I think there was a combination of both, like not having the role models, but also there's a systemic thing that we've watched, and we've watched every time, black people have something good, it gets burned to the ground financially. you know. So I kind of grew up with that. I grew up hating money. I had a really strong, like, say, relationship with money. I don't have a relationship with money anymore, but I had a very strong relationship with money as a child.
I'm laughing as you say that because I'm trying to figure out the juxtaposition of someone who, quote unquote, hated money, didn't have a relationship with money, and ends up being a venture capitalist. Like, however did you go from that in childhood to what you are now?
Yeah, well, I say I had a relationship with money then, and I don't have one now. And what I mean by that is that I used to hate money because it made my mom cry. Mm-hmm. I used to lust after money because it was the only thing I thought that would bring happiness, right? All these very strong emotions tied to money.
Yeah, the scripts, the money scripts, yeah.
Yeah, today I have none of that. And I think that's how I went from. So it's a long story, but it's two books worth and still counting. But I essentially had reached mid 30s or early 30s is when I started looking into this, actually, where I had started all these different, I guess you can call them side hustles and companies, but not officially. I had like T-shirt sales and I did a little drop shipping back in the day before it was this buzzword.
And did you have a college education at this time? Like, did you have any formal education? So you were doing this, you were truly kind of hustling. You were saying,
I was hustling. And I was a very good student in school, in high school, and I was accepted to colleges and very bright. It wasn't that I couldn't get into college or it was this sort of down and out story. It was more like, even if I got a scholarship, I thought I can't stand the thought of leaving my family behind to have to figure out this poverty thing. And I just didn't feel like I would enjoy or get anything from leaving at that point. And then that turned into a few years. And then that kind of, you know, kind of aged out of it, in my opinion. My brother, who is 4 years younger than I am, he was like street hustling. You know, he was out there mostly with like CDs and a little bit of the thing that certain people get paid a lot of money to do now with weed, but which I think is crazy. But I was kind of that version, but in a geekier place. You know, I was always figuring out these things like, you know, mail order or, you know, how many t-shirts can I sell? Or I had started a music magazine and it was, most of these things were not to make they were to make money, but they were to do what I loved while making money. If that makes sense. Like it was like, I just wanted a way to be sustained. I found myself in my early 30s. So this was like 2011, 2012. And I kind of stumbled upon what Silicon Valley was, like this whole idea of startups like Twitter and Airbnb and mostly because of stickers that I saw on Ashton Kutcher's laptop on TV, you know, because he was making these investments and I was using these different things, but I didn't really connect. Oh, these are startups. These were made by like two or three people to start. That's really interesting. So I started researching that. And that's when I realized, oh, that's who I am. I'm a startup founder. I'm an entrepreneur. I just didn't know what to call this. This is why everything has been a little wonky and a little like, you know, just a little off center, right? All of my friends had jobs, real jobs and insurance and the real stuff. They were adults and I was not adulting.
You know, I'm really interested in this idea. So you connect with this identity. You're like the startup world. That's where I fit emotionally, internally. Did you feel like there was space in the startup world for you at that time? Like, did you look at this world and say, ah, this reflects me?
Well, that's exactly the next step was I thought, these are my people. Like, this is it. I have found my group here and we're all weird and we're all going to be super successful. And I thought I was very innocent and cute back then because I thought it was all a meritocracy. Found out it's not. And the beginnings of that were like kind of anecdotal or like talking to other founders. And then there were a couple of research papers that came out very quietly. And I read the statistic like in 2012, 2013 that changed everything for me. And it's that at the time, and in some cases, in some ways today still, 90% of venture funding, the funding that backs these innovative companies, goes to white men in the U.S., where they make up 30% of the U.S. And I'm sitting here in middle of Texas, black gay woman, I feel I'm as smart as any of these other guys that I've been reading about. And I wonder, where's my place? And I start reaching out to people that I read about or that I see interviews with. And I just find their email addresses or find them, you know, online, and I reach out to them. And most of them either don't respond, or I got one from a very well-known investor, and he wrote me back because I had written to him. I said, I'm a Black gay woman. Do you know any lawyers who would help me set up a fund? Mm-hmm. And he wrote back and he said, we don't talk about that here. So I was like, okay. So it was really in finding out that statistic. It was in thinking, now I could go and try to raise money for a company, because I've been building companies or projects forever. Maybe I'll raise money for a company, and that'll be like a tech company. That'll be my thing. I thought about that, and I thought, well, if I do that, first of all, will I be able to? And second of all, will there be anyone else like me there when I get there? And so my whole outlook changed, and it became this calling for me to, I said, what if I raised a fund instead of raising $1 million for my company? I tried to raise $1 million to invest in other founders who look like me or come from different backgrounds. And I just set out on this path, and I thought it was going to be relatively easy, because it's like, oh, well, the white guys, they just didn't know. They didn't know.
Of course. They just overlooked it, right?
I was like, once I tell them with my research here, my little deck and all that, once I tell them, they'll jump on this. I'll be a hero. They'll carry me on their shoulders through. Like I won the Super Bowl. No, that was not the case. And so, but that's how it kicked off. And that started a about 12 years now, long calling that I've been following ever since.
God knows there are millions of ways that we talk about people, whether in business or anything, that are non-white males. And if you look at the type of words that we often use, you'll hear things like underprivileged, right? Or you'll say underserved. And I was really interested, the term you use in the book is underestimated, which I love, because I think in some ways it puts agency back where it belongs. Tell me about why you use that term.
There are a couple of reasons. It was actually gifted to me. I like to think of it as being gifted to me by one of the founders that I invested in early. His name is KG Harris. And we were at a meeting with a few of our founders in San Francisco, in a closed door meeting. And we were kind of all talking about how, you know, different rooms we'd been in and different meetings we'd had and how we were just being so overlooked and discounted. I had invested in all these companies, but I was like them. I was an entrepreneur trying to raise and be out there. And KG stood up and said, you know, let's call this what we really are. We are underestimated. And he's a wordsmith. And I asked him if I could tweet that out and talk a little bit about it. And it really resonated and took off. And in fact, we now have it trademarked in the US and in the UK for finance, because it took off so much. And the reason I continue to use it, even though it was in one conversation, is a couple of reasons. One is I remember usually early on, but it still happens every once in a while. If I get, you know, called out on stage and someone, you know, introduces me and they say anything with the word like underrepresented or anything, you see half the room stand up and go to lunch, no matter what time it is. They all have to go to the bathroom at once, because it's just like, it's like pulling teeth, you know. It's just like, oh no, this is the boring side of the conference. This is when I'm going to be preached at or preached to, right? I'm going to be scolded if I'm a white man, mostly. I'm going to be scolded. When you use underestimated, I started noticing when I used it that white men leaned in. Mm. They were curious. They liked their natural curiosity. And I'm talking about the ones in venture who I would work with. They let their natural curiosity lead them, rather than this whole, like, you know, hand-wringing of, I don't know how to put a Black woman on a board. Right. And it was more like, what am I missing out on? what's this underestimated business you're talking about? You know, so it made things more comfortable, and therefore we could talk about it more. And it made things more competitive, which is what, you know, the dollar signs that these guys are ultimately looking for. On the flip side of that, among women and people of color and LGBTQ plus founders, when we use that word for ourselves, and I've met thousands of them at this point since that was coined by KG, it's empowering, and it gives that agency you were talking about. It gives it back to us, and it's like you're missing out. You just don't know quite what you're standing in front of.
Take that one step further. What do the underestimated offer that we've been missing out on? Because I think this is a real important point here.
It's multiple things, but it's really, you are, there's everyone in this who's listening has been in a situation, I don't care who you are, you've been in a situation where someone did not quite either believe you had the credentials or you are supposed to be in the room, or they overlooked you. And especially someone who is like in sports knows what an advantage that could be. If you're not looking for me, you're not checking for me, you don't think I'm on par with you, well, you know, eat my dust, right? That, I think, so to me, it's this idea of just how many things that the person has to offer that are being overlooked, underestimated by someone else. And so the what I would say early on when I was talking to investors in Silicon Valley who I didn't have contacts, I just found my way and made my way there. And that's when I ended up, you know, home, even more bouts of homelessness. But what I would say is we've done like underestimated people. I wasn't using that phrase yet. I was using underrepresented, but I was saying we have done so much with so little. Imagine what would happen if we had more. And I would even go as far as to say that, and I think some people would agree with me, it's not just an overlooking. It's not just an underestimation. In a lot of cases, it's a blatant sticking the foot out so that you trip up, because there are some people who are so afraid of how powerful we really are on 2 feet, on level playing ground. And so I have experienced both. I've experienced the nuances of everything in between. I just spend my days looking for, what do they say? Look for the helpers. I'm looking for the people who get it, and the people who are open to learning. And I have no ill will or intent towards white men. In fact, most of our investors are white men, because some of them, I joked earlier that if I just told them, they would be surprised. Some of them were aghast at the fact that that was a statistic, and that they knew that they could do something to change that.
We are talking to Arlen Hamilton. She's a 43-year-old author, investor, serial entrepreneur, and podcast host who went from being homeless just a few years ago to now running Backstage Capital. And we are talking about the underestimated in the startup venture capital realm. We're going to take a short break. I'm Doc G, and this is the Earn and Invest podcast. All right, so most of us know the bad news already. If you were using Mint as a budgeting app, it has shut down. But the good news is there's something better, and it's called Monarch Money. I started using Monarch Money myself about 5 months ago, and I knew immediately that I liked it more than any other budgeting app I had ever used. For one, it focuses on collaboration. This is easy to share with your spouse, your partner, your financial advisor. And it's aspirational. Not only can you look at your current budget, but what do you want to buy? What do you want your goals to be? You can focus on those in Monarch Money. It's the next generation of personal finance apps. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Furthermore, you can create custom budgets, track progress toward financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/earn. Again, that's monarchmoney.com/EARN. What I like about this app is it's intuitive, easy to use, quick to sign on. It's collaborative, as we talked about. It's customizable. The idea is you can use this app the way you want to use it. And the reason why is the Monarch Money team is customer focused. They are focusing on you, me, and all the other people who want to use this app to live a better financial life. After trying out Monarch Money for myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, listeners of this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/earn. That's monarchmoney.com/EARN for your extended 30-day free trial. You know what? I love our meals from Factor. My son started getting them about a year ago when he needed a quick alternative to meals on the go. But where we've really enjoyed them is we've been remodeling our kitchen. That's right, we've had no access to our kitchen for the last few weeks. And some nights, we just had no idea what to do for a meal. That is where Factor came in. We would just pop the meal in the microwave, and 2 minutes later, we'd have a fantastic meal. You can do the exact same thing, and there's tons of variety. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week. These are chef-prepared meals, and let me tell you, they are delicious. No fuss, no mess. You just put it in the microwave, and 2 minutes later, you have a meal. This is tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. Head to factormeals.com/earn50 and use your code EARN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code EARN50 at factormeals.com/earn50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. We are back with Arlen Hamilton, and her book is Your First Million, Why You Don't Have to Be Born into a Legacy of Wealth to Leave One Behind. And we are talking about the underestimated in Silicon Valley. Let's jump to more modern day. You are running Backstage Capital, and the pandemic hits, and we know because of world events that corporate America has all of a sudden realized, okay, there's a problem here. Right? We do not have people of color. We do not have other represented groups being part of our corporate and startup culture. And so they come to you to help change things. Did you feel like corporate America at that point was really interested in making change, or were they just kind of going through the motions?
I felt at the time that most of them were going through the motions. But I also felt like if that's what was needed to make real change happen, that was going to have to be okay. I remember being interviewed for maybe TechCrunch or something of that nature. And I said, you know, it's not even close to enough, but it's something. And we have to move forward with something, you know. I was offended most, you know, and I know how pretentious that sounds, but I was offended by the amounts that were being thrown out in a lot of those cases when it came to companies and other people's funds, where I could see how much they were bringing in revenue or maybe had under management if there were a fund, and then the pennies they were offering.
In other words, they were giving a small amount of money, but it was nowhere near the type of funding you'd expect in these situations.
Exactly. And I was offended because, and some people might say, well, at least they're doing something, right? Because that's kind of what I just said. But I was offended because they were also, you're going to get untold amounts of good karma, goodwill, good, you know, great marketing that money couldn't even buy. To do these, to put these things out. And so to get all of that in exchange for what I know is really going to translate to pennies to our founders, I just thought it was a slap in the face for many of them. There were a few that I found to be interesting and true to their word, and you know, we could actually see the effects of.
So if we were being optimistic, and this is very optimistic, but let's say there was a 50% improvement, we would still be a far way off. So if you're one of these people who are right now listening to you and said, you know what, this idea, this terminology of being underestimated really seems to fit me. Corporate America is not jumping into the save the day. Most venture capital, not backstage capital, but most venture capital is not jumping in to save the day. What do you do if you feel like you fall into that group? Maybe you have a good idea. Maybe you want to build a business. Where do you go?
After a decade with Backstage, investing in more than 200 companies under this mandate, raising more than $30 million from scratch after being homeless, I can tell you that even though my job today still is to make investments, which we do, I'm most excited by helping founders figure out that they do not need outside funding. And it's the teach a man to fish scenario. Because we totally realized these last few years, no one is coming to save us. But the cool thing is that entrepreneurship is more accessible than ever. It's cheaper than ever. It's easier than ever. All of these things that you couldn't have said 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, it was is multiples easier than it was 10 years prior to that. And of course, it's not get rich quick overnight. That doesn't exist unless you win the lottery or, you know, you have some viral moment. But there are steps to it. That's why I wrote Your First Million. That's why I have a masterclass. There are steps to you take your lived experience and you combine that with your interests and you find your fulfillment. You know, it's a combination of things. And you find out, you combine that with what the market is looking for or what they're willing to pay for, what it's willing to pay for. And most of us have something that we can monetize. And then you pair that with doing a true diagnostic of what do you really need in order to live a quality life that you want. If you weren't thinking about what other people were thinking, how much, what's that number? And you compare, like you find a way to meet in the middle of, okay, this is what I need to leave that corporate job or maybe keep the corporate job because I like it, but have a safety net. And I think that to me is like the really exciting play. So that to get into that mindset of I'm not here to teach you how to go out and raise money. I'm here to teach you that generating revenue for yourself is quite possible.
We've been talking about personal solutions, community solutions. Are we underplaying legislative solutions? I mean, should we be pushing for more aggressive legislative change to even things out?
Sure. I think we need it all. I've definitely been part of conversations through now 3 administrations about this. And the problem with certain things like the SEC regulations that help with crowdfunding, for instance, it's time intensive. Like it takes so long to get things changed, and then they'll change it and then they'll like spend a year to see how it works. And it's this incremental change, and then they'll base it on that. And if anything goes wrong, and then, you know, they pull back. And then it's also based on the administration. By the time you get an administration that you're aligned with, they have, you know, 2.5 years really of their 4 years to really do anything. By the time you figure out who does what and who you can connect with, not much gets done. So I definitely do. And I have faith that over the next few years, it'll play a major role.
Well, Arlen, I wanted to thank you for coming on the show today. As I was reading your book, I was really caught by that term underestimated. And the reason why is because it made me think of the underdog. And what I love about the underdog is almost always mighty. And I think that's the feeling and the spirit I get as I read your book. I want to end this episode the way I end every episode, by asking you about your book and where people can find it. So the book is out as of January 1st. What is the best way for people to go purchase your book and read all this wonderful goodness?
Thank you so much. Yes, Your First Million is available almost everywhere you can pick up a book. I would suggest, too, you can go to the library. There are library copies. You can get an audio version on Amazon, Google, other places. Definitely available on Amazon, on Libby.com. Please support your indie bookstores. I've been doing a book tour for the past 6 or 8 weeks. I can't remember at this point. And it has just been so, so fulfilling to go into these indie bookstores and see the beautiful. I mean, it's like walking into a museum in some cases. Like, it's just gorgeous works of art. So definitely look out there if you can, and make sure you get this for somebody who also needs to read it. Don't keep all that to yourself, because that's a big part of what I talk about in the book. It's like sharing this information. I'm called a key maker, not a gatekeeper.
And what is the best way to get in touch with you or reach out to you if people have questions?
I am all over Instagram. So Arlan Was Here, A-R-L-A-N, Was Here on Instagram. You can DM me on Instagram, and I do check my messages. You can go to backstagecapital.com to see our portfolio. If you are interested in seeing if we'd be a good fit for your company and you think you're ready, we do have an open application process where a lot of our apprentices look through on a weekly basis, look at any of the applications. And that's very rare for a venture fund to have. So there's a lot of content I've put out there. The books, both books, It's About Damn Time is the first book. And also my YouTube channel, Arlan's Your First Million is my YouTube channel. So much free information that I want people to have access to.
The book is Your First Million, Why You Don't Have to Be Born into a Legacy of Wealth to Leave One Behind. Arlan Hamilton, thank you so much for being on Earn and Invest today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it, Todd.
That's a wrap. Earn and Invest is now part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to this show, as well as other fine podcasts. All right, tell me the truth. Could you see me bopping away at a Janet Jackson concert? I loved doing this episode today, not just because we were at the same Janet Jackson concert, albeit in different cities, but during the same tour, but I really connected with what Arlan said about being the underestimated. I love that term, and I've been thinking a lot about it in terms of this idea of being the underdog. If any of you saw my economy speech from what must have been 2020, it was the first economy. And in it, I do a series of vignettes. And one of the vignettes is about my theme song growing up. It was this rap song about being the underdog. And in fact, that's always how I've hyped myself up, is this idea of being the underdog, being underestimated, and using that as a motivation to achieve things. Strangely enough, I see a connection to this, to watching Breakpoint. I don't know if any of you guys watch the Netflix documentary Breakpoint. It's about tennis players. But one thing you'll see is when you watch these tennis matches, you'll occasionally have a highly seeded player, a number one, number two, number three, lose to a number 20 or 50 or 100, someone well below them in the ranks. And you'll often hear them say that being the underdog, being the underestimated, there's not that much pressure on them, whereas being number one or two, there is a huge amount of pressure to produce. And that's the thing about being the underestimated, is that no one expects anything of you, and therefore you have the power and the control and the strength to show up and prove everyone wrong. And I think this gets back to something I've talked a lot about when I talk about purpose and the hero's journey and how meaning relates. as I said before in the past, meaning is about our past. It's how we cognitively think about that which has happened to us, and purpose is about our present and future. It's how we do joyful things now and tomorrow. If you think about being the underdog, what you're really doing is you're creating a hero's journey for yourself in which you are the underestimated, and yet you now have the option, the ability to step forward and surprise everyone. The underdog, the underestimated are often stronger than everyone thinks. They're more capable, they're more educated, they've been through more, and yet they are not being seen. And what better way to tell yourself that hero's journey than to think of yourself as the underdog who's going to step up and upset the likely winner, upset the number one seed, upset the status quo? And I think that's exactly what Arlen is talking about, this idea that just because you're underestimated doesn't mean that you're incapable or undervaluable. Let me say that again. Just because you're underestimated doesn't mean that you're incapable or undervaluable. And if you can realize this, and then you can use that mindset to help you in the future, you can walk into every situation feeling like you're the underdog. You have something to prove, and yet you have nothing to lose, because everyone expects you to fail in the first place, but you know better. You know you're more capable. You know you have the skills. You know you have the capacity to succeed, even though other people underestimate you. I found this outlook very helpful in my life. I think it can be very helpful in yours. There are truly people out there who are underestimated, not just people like us who might use that as a mechanism to walk ourselves through the hero's journey and to find meaning in life, but there are also people out there who truly have been underestimated. And I think Arlen does a great job of arguing why, A, we need to stop underestimating people, and B, that their skills and abilities can serve us as investors, and serve us in our community. I'd like to end the show by asking, do you feel underestimated and why? And have you felt like the underdog? Is that something you felt in your past? And have you gotten past it, or do you still feel like the underdog today? I leave things just running in case we catch anything in the after show. You hanging in there?
Yeah, I was starting to get real congested. So
I
was
like, yeah, I just wanted to make sure that we got the, like I said, the real goodness of the book, because yeah. I want to make sure people get to hear it. I just thought really highly of the book. It was a pleasure to read. It was easy to read. It flowed really nicely, just a beautiful style to it. It's really hard with a book like yours to not go too far in the details. And you have that really nice mix of both details, inspiration, and a well-written book.
Thank you.
And so I really felt like you did a nice job on all three of those things. And I know it's really hard to mix your story, the actual details of how you did it, and then make it flow and sound good.
That's right. That's right. I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and if you want to send that video clip to my team, they can have you review me.
Yeah, I can. What I can do is I can take this whole video clip, send it to your team, and anything they want to take out of it or anything they want to take out of the audio, they are fine to do that. They're fine to put it out whenever they want, even if it's before I put my whole thing out. I'm not worried about it. So if your team can use any of it. Go ahead.
They do like little video clips, I think.
Yeah. And they can use any of it, anything I've said in this whole time, anything you've said, it's totally fine for me.
Okay.
Anything that can help you keep promoting and getting the word out. So
awesome. Thank you. Earn and Invest podcast for the team.
Yeah. And I loved reading about Janet Jackson because, again, I happened to go to her concert right in that same time period. So I remember.
Love that. I love that. That's amazing. Yeah.
I'm a little bit older than you, but otherwise.
Yeah, you said you were what?
I'm 50 years old. So I was in college.
Yeah.
In 93. I was, I think, a sophomore or junior in college.
Yeah.
It feels really good to be productive, but a lot of the time it's easier said than done, especially when you need to make time to learn about productivity so you can actually, you know, be productive. But you can start your morning off right and be ready to get stuff done in just a few minutes with the Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day podcast. New episodes drop every weekday, so listen and subscribe to Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts. That's Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts.
You care about your money. Of course you do. So why aren't you listening to SoFi Daily? This podcast will keep you updated on the latest news in the stock market and how it could impact your financial life. Stay on top of what's happening. Listen to SoFi Daily wherever you get your podcasts. That's SoFi Daily wherever you get your podcasts.